This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
The same thing that we heard about coal, when you hear it today from, you know, oil and gas, that fossil fuels will still be 70% of the energy we use in 2040, I think they're out of their minds.
What would it take for North America to really reduce pollution? At a minimum, Canada, the US, and Mexico would have to jointly commit to increasing renewable energy sources and eliminating fossil fuel subsidies. Fortunately, these three nations just signed on to the North American Clean Economy Agreement, which includes these commitments and many others aimed at improving the environment. Author and sustainability consultant Andrew Winston joins us today on Sea Change Radio to explain the ins and outs of the agreement. We discuss its importance, dissect the specific pledges made by the three countries, and look at what steps must be taken to achieve the goals listed in this unprecedented agreement. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Andrew Winston. He's an author and sustainability consultant. Andrew, welcome back to Sea Change Radio.
Glad to be here. Thanks for having me again.
Last time we had you on, you had discussed your most recent book, The Big Pivot. Why don't you catch us up on what you've been working on since then?
In a lot of ways, I've just continued the work of the Big Pivot. It's my first book, Green to Gold, I think came out at kind of the perfect time. There was this wave of interest in business. This book, I feel like it came out a little bit early. I was saying that companies need to be a lot more aggressive about the shifts in how they do business, you know, based on the scale of the challenges we're facing, like climate. And what's happened is, kind of after the book came out, I think the scale of the challenges we're facing got a lot clearer to people. And so I've seen a real big, you know, pickup in kind of interest in corporate sustainability just in the last, you know, 6, 8, 10 months with the Paris Accords and the Pope and, you know, just all sorts of big things have changed over the last year. So I've continued that work. I continue to speak and consult and write and try to catalyze change in how business is done. That's my work in whatever form I can do it.
And you recently wrote a piece for the Harvard Business Review entitled Six Ways the North American Clean Economy Agreement Will Affect Business. I wanted to use that kind of as a launching pad for a larger discussion, but a lot of people are not really familiar with this pact. Many Sea Change Radio listeners are aware of the Paris Accord, but
right.
This North American agreement kind of flew a little bit more under the radar. Could you first summarize it for us, and then we'll dive into it?
Yeah, sure. I mean, it wasn't like I was there with what they called the Three Amigos. I kind of read the announcements that they put out and looked at what they had to say, and it was, a really interesting, you know, agreement. You've got this, and a lot, it was in the same kind of week to 10 days as Brexit. So you had this really weird dichotomy of Europe looking like it was maybe coming apart and North America, in a way, kind of getting its act together. And so the three country leaders who kind of all are very young for their role and kind of good looking and kind of marching around and looking very happy to be together, said, hey, we're forging a new future. And it included a bunch of agreements around how they would build a clean economy together. And the big one that got the press was we're going to be 50% clean power by 2025 across the continent. And we can dig into, you know, whether that was actually such a big deal or not. But there were lots of other things, like we're going to align standards on appliances and cars and trucks, and we're going to integrate our electric grids, and we're going to pursue the policies that we need to meet the Paris Climate Accord, where, you know, we're going to agree as a region to do what we need to. We're going to get rid of fossil fuel subsidies. We're going to reduce methane emissions in oil and gas. I mean, they're tackling some very big, very thorny problems. I mean, especially for three countries that now have very large oil and gas industries. These are three of the biggest producers in the world now. So it was interesting to see how much they were taking on, in a lot of ways, vested interests to build this new clean economy.
Let's dive into the methane one. Just, I know it probably wasn't the headline from most people who read it, but it stuck out to me because it goes to the heart of the matter when it comes to natural gas. How will the natural gas industry be able to adapt to this new standard? Will it be able to kind of face its leakage problem, as you write?
I don't know. It's a good question. I mean, the big challenge, obviously, with natural gas, the main reason that we, on the surface in the U.S., have reduced emissions or have been able to decouple, which is kind of the hot word, decouple our growth in recent years from emissions, is the move from coal to natural gas. And, you know, at the utility level, at the power plant level, burning natural gas is much cleaner, right? It is lower carbon dioxide per, you know, unit of energy. But what's dangerous about it is that plenty of studies show that there's leakage throughout the value chain of natural gas. And this is where it gets really tricky because, you know, you get into the difference between, a point source in EPA terms, a point source of like a power plant, and a, you know, diffuse spread out source of pipelines that run thousands of miles, or trucks, or the digging, equipment itself, or where the wells are, there is leakage. And it's sometimes hard to see and it's hard to measure. But what they're saying is, you know, the industry has got to spend some time and money to figure it out and to try to cap these leaks.
So are there any teeth to this proclamation that the natural gas industry will be cleaning up its act?
I don't think there is yet. I mean, I these kinds of agreements are always intentional, and you could say, well, it's nice they came together and shook hands. But, for the most part, these administrations have followed through, and the Obama administration has had many policies in place on a lot of the other issues. This one, I think, is going to be a little bit challenging, I don't know what the exact laws will need to be or should be to do this. I think, you know, requiring the industry to track and report is most likely what the government can demand, at least to begin with, right? Is at least getting better data and more transparency. I can almost guarantee that will happen. And that will be part of what's expected of the industry, from a regulatory perspective. And I don't actually know who would be overseeing that. I mean, I suppose it would be the EPA, but you could probably argue for some other ones as well.
And do you know if the 50% clean power goal by 2025 includes natural gas as part of that quote unquote clean power or not?
As I read it, and I think what they meant, it did not. I mean, what they said was clean, as they defined it, seemed to be the clear renewables, solar, wind, geothermal, and biomass. That's what, you know, most people call, like, you know, renewables. And then it includes hydropower and nuclear. And those are the ones that, you know, are more controversial. But, part of what I wrote in these pieces that I wrote about it was, you know, without those two, there's no way they get to 50. With those two, 50's not, arguably not that hard because Canada's already there.
Why don't you break that down a little bit more? You write it very clearly, but for our listeners, why don't you explain how this 50% goal could add up? Canada's already there. So with the shortfalls that the U.S. currently have, as well as Mexico, how will they kind of come aboard?
Yeah, no. So what's interesting is I just kind of ran a spreadsheet and kind of backed out some assumptions about the current grid and what would need to happen to get to this 50% goal by 2025. And currently, I was even a little surprised. I had a sense, but didn't realize that Canada was already at 81% clean energy in their electric grid.
That's really stunning, isn't it?
It is, but that's because right now 60% of their grid is hydropower. You know, they're a huge supplier of hydropower. That's electricity, right? That's not total energy in your economy because, you know, Canada's a giant, you know, producer of oil. So this is the electricity. This is that part of the energy equation. And, you know, it's a big part. And so they're at 60% hydro, they're, you know, 16% nuclear and 5%. You know, all three countries have, you know, single digit percentage of the real true renewables. And it's growing fast, but those are still small. If you're assuming that, and I think you have to, given what they've said and kind of where the markets are, that to get to 50% across the continent, that the growth has to come entirely in renewables, then there's some significant things that need to happen in the growth of pure renewables. Because I don't believe you're going to see much more hydropower. You know, the big rivers that are dammed, and if anything, nuclear power is under some pressure for shutdowns. There's some plans to phase out some of the big nuclear plants in North America.
Right here in California, Diablo Canyon just
got
shuttered, and I think in the Northeast, what do you have? The Yankee one in Seabrook, that's been shut down.
There's Indian Point, and which is part of the power around where I live, and I think there's three nuclear plants in New York State that have been slated to be shut down. And I'm just, you know, as I was kind of thinking about this agreement and talking to people and talking to some experts on utilities, I had a good conversation with a utility consultant and energy consultant. And she was basically saying, like, if they shut down these nuclear, you know, New York State's not going to meet its own 50% goal, which it's set recently, and the continent won't. So I think we're going to see, you know, that's what's interesting about this, is there going to be a tension between some competing demands and some competing desires about our energy system. And I'm not saying we should go build more nuclear. I don't think that's going to happen anyways.
It would take decades anyway, right?
Right. To get one online by 2025 is nearly impossible if you started today. But what I am saying is I've probably come around to thinking we shouldn't shut them down so quickly if we're going to meet our carbon goals. I think we're going to see rapid acceleration of the solar and wind markets. They'll continue to accelerate because the cost just keeps dropping. You know, it's 20% of the U.S., it's 16% of Canada, it's a small percentage in Mexico. At least keeping that capacity, because it provides that baseload power for now. Because I believe that over the next 8 or 9 years, by this 2025 goal, you'll see significant reductions in the costs of renewables and significant reductions in the costs of batteries and the technologies for storage. And we're going to see much better integration of renewable power, which, you know, as critics have pointed out for a long time, has its ups and downs, because obviously solar stops when the sun goes down and wind stops when the wind stops blowing. And so you need some smoothing.
Tocar guitarra, me gusta cantar el sol. El mariachi me acompaña cuando canto mi canción. Me gusta tomar mis copas, aguardiente es lo mejor. También el tequila blanco con su sal de la sabor. Ay, 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 mi amor. Ay, mi morena de mi corazón. Ay, 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 mi amor. Ay, mi morena de mi corazón.
To listen to Sea Change Radio anytime, anyplace, just subscribe to our free podcast. Simply follow the link from seachangeradio.com or search for us in the iTunes podcast directory.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to author and sustainability consultant Andrew Winston. So, Andrew, let's talk about one of the other bullet points in the North American Clean Economy Agreement is phasing out fossil fuel subsidies by 2025 and calling on the G20 to do the same. That seems like kind of a difficult thing to do internally here in the U.S. How could we get three countries to agree on it at the same time? Is this a feasible target?
It's a good question you ask. You know, of the things that they've proposed, you know, phasing out subsidies, you know, may be the hardest. I think you've got what's the political phrase? You know, it depends on whose ox is gored by any change in a policy. And, you know, the subsidies that are in place go to so many different parties and so many, you know, companies and industries with a lot of political power in all three countries. It is hard to see that. I think you're seeing, you know, real discussion politically around should we put a price on carbon in some way? You know, some discussion about moving subsidies out of energy entirely. I think if there's any hope of taking away fossil fuel subsidies, it would probably come through taking away really all energy subsidies in some way and just saying, let's create a level playing field and renewables should win.
After subsidizing the fossil fuel industry for a century, now we're going to have a level playing field, right?
I agree. I think that's kind of absurd. And I've had this debate, I appeared once on Fox Business debating with someone about this subsidy issue, and you know, their attitude was, you know, renewables shouldn't need it, they should be economic without it, and it's just, and they were talking about the
Solyndra,
right. That's all, it's all about Solyndra, but it's also about, you know, that this is somehow you know, companies just taking from the government and from taxpayers. And they said that, you know, nobody should get subsidies. And I said, if you take that attitude, then you'd basically be mad at pretty much every industry. You know, I mean, every sector has some form of tax subsidies, or, you know, there's so many tweaks to the tax code, you know, depreciation of equipment. There's so many ways we do this.
Or if you're complaining about your $2 or $3 gas, try going anywhere else in the world where it's
right.
Two, three, four times that price.
Right. I was just in Italy on business and for fun and driving around a bit. And it is closer to, you know, $7, $8 a gallon in effect. You know, it's per liter, but it's so much more expensive there. And it does, you know, you can see why the cars are smaller. And why, you know, I mean, we have very short attention spans, I think. You know, the oil prices dropped starting about a year and a half ago, and the gas prices followed. And then Americans started buying giant cars again. You know, and it's remarkable to me because it's so short-sighted, because we don't know that oil prices are going to stay down. The subsidies probably, you know, don't really affect oil price too much. They're really, I think, kind of a massive giveaway. And, you know, the fossil fuel industry, well, you got to break it into parts. The coal industry is in bankruptcy mode, but, you know, the oil industry is incredibly wealthy and very, very profitable, and really doesn't need subsidies to go produce, to explore and produce. But, you know, yes, as ridiculous as it is, I think it's more politically feasible that you'd get rid of all subsidies. But I think in reality, we're not going to get rid of any of them. So, you know, they're going to continue as they are because it's just, there's too much political clout behind them.
When I read your blurb on coal, I was pretty stunned, actually. I didn't realize, I knew that things were dire for the coal industry, but why don't you summarize the research that you found when you were writing this piece?
Yeah, I mean, look, the coal industry is in a death spiral. I mean, that's kind of the common term, but it's very clear. And it's a very strange situation because it's still providing an enormous percentage of the electricity around the world. We're still at 30-ish in the U.S., and China's over half. And, you know, there's plenty of places where it's still a dominant form. But at the same time, the industry can't seem to really make money anymore. And the kind of biggest indication was that the market valuations of the biggest coal companies in North America have dropped 90% in the last 5 years. I mean, they've basically...
90%.
90%.
That's just stunning, yeah. Isn't it?
No, it's an amazing number. It really is. And, you know, you rarely see a shift that big in an industry. I mean, it's like equivalent to everybody's favorite, you know, whipping boy Blockbuster when Netflix came in, you know, and if, you know, a few years before they disappeared, they were poo-pooing that it could happen to them. And, you know, just 3 to 5 years ago, if you said coal's really going to go under, people looked at you like you were crazy.
Or 10 years ago.
Right. 10 years ago, especially.
After I read that spot, I went back into my email and I was like, I got to find this email from this friend of mine. I have an old college buddy who was working for a major bank as an energy analyst at the time. And I had posted some article about Texas needs our help to ward off a coal catastrophe. And I'm just going to read this because now I get to gloat a little. Let me just quote this to you. He said, "I hate to say it, but you're blowing against the wind on this. Coal is cheap, oil is expensive, and we're the Saudi Arabia of coal. That's all you need to know, and it won't only be in Texas. You're talking about hurting U.S. jobs and miners, relying more on foreign oil and gas, not popular in Washington. The good thing is companies like GE putting billions into clean coal research. Take a look at that." And then he goes on to give me some talking points of, you know, IGCC, the Integrated Gasification Combined Cycles. He's like, they got all these projects going on. Coal is the future. basically. So I get to gloat for a second. That's the advantage of having your own radio program. Is
you can track everything ever said. No, I actually wish people would go back and look at predictions more often because they're so, you know, we're so bad, I think. I mean, there's plenty of studies that show that just humans in general, we're very bad at projecting. We're bad at projecting things that are exponential or don't move linearly. You know, we kind of think things will just increase at a typical rate, and you just don't get And this is exactly what happened to Blockbuster, right? It was like, well, how could you stream a movie? It'll take 5 hours to stream a movie. It's like they didn't do the math that the technology was doubling every, you know, year or two, and that you'd be streaming it, you know, in minutes within a kind of predictable number of years. And there's great charts now of the cost of solar, and there's a very, you know, exponential line. It's a straight line in a log curve, you know, in very math terms. And you can see it over 40 years, and especially over the last six, and there's these tipping points. And I think we're going to see the same with storage. And so, you know, mark my words, and I could be wrong, but the same thing that we heard about coal, when you hear it today from, you know, oil and gas, that fossil fuels will still be 70% of the energy we use in 2040, I think they're out of their minds. And it's not just because the world is waking up to how dangerous and how imminent climate change is. And I think that is one of the main reasons we're not going to do it. It's also just the economics.
And you do this every day when you work with businesses. They're not just looking at good PR. They're looking at their bottom line, right?
Right. One of the things that's happened in the last couple of years is that the amount of corporate buying of renewable energy has gone up dramatically. You know, last year it was 3.5 gigawatts, which is a lot. You know, a gigawatt's like a big nuclear plant. You know, it was a pretty significant amount of buying, and a decent chunk of the new capacity put on the grid was corporate buying. This is you know, big tech companies like Google and Amazon and Microsoft and, you know, Cisco, and then some big industrials have gotten into the game. And none of these guys did it because they were looking at the polar bears and worrying about climate change. I mean, of course it was part of their carbon strategy and their climate strategy, and they're aware of that. But they all found a way to do it for the same or lower price as their current energy, with some very small exceptions. Now, nothing's a guarantee. You know, these guys have locked in prices for renewables for a number of years. And, you know, if energy prices drop more, it could turn out that they're paying a little bit more for the renewables. But it's not inherently more expensive today. And this is the big myth. And so, you know, they're going to buy more and more of it because it's just flat out cheaper. And, you know, when you go back and say, when someone says coal is dirt cheap, there's just a very basic economic thing here, which is, it may be cheap in current structure of our economy and the tax breaks and all of that, but the reality is the variable cost, how much it costs to give you the next bit of energy, for solar is zero and wind is zero, right? Like, once you've got it up, once you've got the solar on your roof, it's zero cost. Then the marginal cost for coal is that you still have to go blow up a mountain and dig it up and transport it and burn it. And there's nothing that will ever change that.
This is Alex Wise on SeaChange Radio. I'm speaking to author and sustainability consultant Andrew Winston. So, Andrew, one thing that you didn't cover in your Harvard Business Review piece was NAFTA. A lot of people look at NAFTA as a template for what can go wrong with trade, and TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, is right now under a similar magnifying glass. Did NAFTA play a role in these three countries, the U.S., Canada, and Mexico, coming together to create this clean economy agreement?
You know, I don't know. It's an interesting perspective. I don't know if specifically NAFTA was a part of this discussion. I guess you could argue that, you know, NAFTA's been a part of how these countries think of themselves as an economic unit, right? Just like the EU and all its structures has increased, you know. So I'm sure it has on some level that it is more of an economic unit. So it was easier to think of, hey, should we harmonize some of our standards, efficiency standards, and could we link up our grids? Because they have some experience, you know, with these trade deals.
You start off the piece talking about how the EU took a potentially fatal blow with the Brexit thing, right?
Right.
So it was, it kind of rang true as well. It was like, well, here you have a similar union that was kind of formed.
This is clearly a sign of moving towards more cooperation and kind of group thinking on a big challenge. What I don't know is if how NAFTA played into it specifically. I think it's, you know, probably all part of the history of how these three economic units work together. Now, the one thing, you know, we didn't talk about before about this was that the main conclusion I made in kind of running the numbers was that it's all on the U.S. because to get to this 50% number, Canada's already there, and Mexico is just not a large percentage of the production. So the change, just by numbers, just by scale, has to be in the U.S. The U.S. is producing over 80% of the electricity of the three countries. That's also partly a reflection of how inefficient we are per dollar of GDP versus some developed countries, and our level of development versus Mexico. Right? We use a lot per person, and we're a more advanced country, a richer country, using more energy.
Let me quote you here from your piece where it says, first, the U.S. generates 82% of the energy on the continent. Second, Canada is already well beyond the 50% mark with 59% from hydro alone. So even if Mexico hits its aggressive target of going from 22% to 35% renewables, the U.S. will have to go from 33% to 46%. So can we get to 46%?
I think so. I think it's going to be tough, but doable. I mean, I ran the numbers.
Before we even run any numbers, we have to talk about the big orange elephant in the room, Donald Trump, right? Kind of falls under that umbrella of, like, as long as we have somebody who believes in climate change, that we can and will stick by America's agreements, we can actually operate like a rational actor in the world.
Right. Look, I know everyone tries to avoid talking politics too much, but you're right. We can't talk about this agreement. And I do in my piece kind of say the same thing, like, you know, all bets are off if Trump wins the presidency. To some extent, the kinds of things that the countries can agree to could completely blow up as an agreement. I do think that the trend towards renewable energy and what companies are doing will continue. Because, as I said, because of the economics and because all the reasons the companies are doing it is not really because of pressure from governments. You know, it makes sense for their business. So I do think that will continue. But yes, things like standards, the agreement with the car industry to raise fuel efficiency standards, that's a government effort. You know, you need an executive branch that actually thinks this is worthwhile, and thinks that the jobs that we're creating and will continue to create in the clean economy are valuable, and not just the jobs that are lost in the old economy, you know, old energy system, which, you know, is a serious problem. It is, right? There's parts of the country that are going to lose out as we move from fossil fuels. But the question in my mind is, what do we do to help those people? Not how do we stop progress from happening? I mean, that's never really worked out when anybody tries to stop progress. It doesn't happen. I mean, I mean, obviously the political situation could really wreak havoc. But as I said, you know, the rest of the world's going to continue. I do think the pressure on reducing carbon, on moving to renewables, it's all going to continue. But obviously we need someone in power, in a leadership position, who believes that this is a big problem that we can and should solve, that it's valuable for the economy, that it's valuable for business, that it's the right move to build this clean economy. These three current leaders obviously do.
Of Mexico, Canada, and the U.S.
Right. That's right.
It's a great piece. We'll link to it on SeaChange Radio. Author, sustainability consultant, Andrew Winston. Andrew, thanks so much for being my guest on SeaChange Radio.
Glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise.
Additional music by Charles Erland, Los Lobos, and Neil Young.
Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.